Doesn't it seem like we were just here? Okay, I just wanted to double check. It's not just me. Well, hello, hello, hello. I'm showing up all at one time, so you don't think that I forgot about you, since I'm hardly ever here, and now it feels like I've been here for 2 weeks. That's great, though. I feel great. We're going to talk about a great subject tonight. My name's Tuere Salah, and so let's check and see if anyone's here at Seattle Insight for the first time. We'll see you in the hall. Well, hello. What about in the online? Is there anybody here who's here for the first time? There's kind of like an echo here. So I'm one of the guiding teachers here. And some of us in this room just spent a weekend here doing a kind of like a non-residential retreat, which was quite sweet, very nice. And tonight we're going to continue with our teaching theme on the Four Noble Truths, and we're coming to the Fourth Noble Truth. So I'll do a little bit of a framing, but we'll have a talk. We'll sit for about 40 minutes, 35, something like that. And then we'll take a break and come back, and I'll have a talk, and then we'll open it up, save some time for some questions or response if anybody has anything. All right? A poem by Lucille Clifton. May the tide that is entering even now the lip of our understanding carry you out beyond the face of fear. May the tide that is entering even now the lip of our understanding carry you out beyond the face of fear. May you kiss the wind, then turn from it, certain that it will love your back. Maybe may you open your eyes to water, water waving forever. And may you, in your innocence, sail through this to that. Tonight we're going to talk about this Fourth Noble Truth, the path itself. We've been kind of looking at all these Noble Truths all year. And this is fourth month, Fourth Noble Truth. And then we're going to spend the rest of the year going through this path one factor at a time. So these, just to put a framing around here, for those of you that don't know about them, the Buddha's original Dhamma talk came from this Four Noble Truths. And this is how he said that he became awakened. So because we're talking about the Fourth Noble Truth, I get to talk about one of my favorite suttas. But one of the things that we have to be careful with is that we, in English, we talk with nouns. And so we call these the Four Noble Truths. And there's a way in which that sounds like it's four pronouncements. There's a this, a this, a this, and a this. and these four things that I should learn. But in truth, these truths are more like verbs, and so they unfold over time, and gradually there's this understanding that begins to happen, and they weave with one another. So in a way, it's better to think of these as four ennobling truths. They ennoble us towards a level of dignity and integrity, and I think divinity. They bring a bit of a sacredness into everything that we do. I want to share this sutta of mine that I, well, it's not mine, but I just happen to love it. It's about when the Buddha first awakened. And it's said that he walked around the tree for 7 days, thanking it for sort of supporting him through his awakening. He was that sort of, it just felt that much love. And I think in some respects, what we are ennobling towards is a level of love that we're not used to connecting with. We're not used to being in love with the world the way I think we become in love with the world, the more ennobled we get. The more we practice, the more in love with the world we get. And this moment in time with the Buddha, he was circling this tree. It's almost like there was nobody there when he awakened except for him and the tree. And all of that love, all of that understanding, he poured it into the one being that was alive with him, that kind of knew what had happened. No one else knew. I mean, for those of you that don't know, when the Buddha left his path and went off, you know, he went off on his path. At one point, he went with a group of friends, and they went to do a much harsher path. He was younger, you know, he's a young man. And he wanted to do this harsher, more intense kind of ascetic practice. And but he was really just dying. It wasn't really working very well. And his friends left him because he decided to try something different. And he had to get his strength back. So as soon as he started eating, they left him. And so he practiced this thing that he kind of wondered about. And it actually led to his awakening. And it's kind of strange talking about it like that, because there's a part of me when I first started practicing that was like, what is this awakening? What does that mean? Does the world look different? Do I look different? What happens in this idea that you awaken? And I think, you know, my years of being on the path, I am less believing in this idea that I would be some kind of strange being, and more believing that I am not afraid of what shows up in the world. That it's less about becoming something unique and more about sort of being with the world the way the world is, being with life the way the life is, that we're not always walking around in this fear, and that you're present enough that you can be with this world we live in that's very unknown and we never can control. So when he awakens, it's just him and the tree. And he's so overwhelmed that he thanks this tree over and over and over and over and over. And as he's walking around thanking this tree, he's in this very peaceful state. And we get glimpses of this. We even had some glimpses of it over the weekend. You get glimpses of a very peaceful state that you can tell it is possible for us to have these states where we're okay. We're just not trapped in our worried mind. And he's very still. He's very sensitive. And I think he probably had a great deal of joy. And in that moment, he thinks, I should go tell my friends. I should go teach this. I mean, I found something. Let me go teach it. And right after that thought, he had another thought that was like, wait a minute. If I go teach this and people don't get it, I'm going to be vexed. It's just going to disrupt my soul, and I will be, you know, vexed. And so he said, yeah, enough of that teaching. Now we're just going to rest back in the stillness. And I have been in that place where you come to an end of a retreat and you're so peaceful that the last thing you want to do is go be with people. Let's just stay here, tucked in, not go anywhere else. And so there's a part of me that can truly understand that feeling of being still and settled. And oftentimes, Dhamma, when people go on meditation retreats or we do this meditation, we're treated as if this is what our whole practice is, just trying to get still and steady, and we like it and it's nice. And we do like this kind of peacefulness that comes with the practice. But in truth, the Buddha didn't stay there. Out of compassion, in this recognition that his friends and probably other people, he realized that it would kind of be, it would be harsh of him. Maybe I shouldn't say it. He didn't say it would be harsh. He just said, he just began to realize that there would be people who he could tell them a few things and they could awaken also. That he could share what he had learned and people could find their way. And so he decided that even though some people weren't going to believe him, some people weren't going to understand, some people were going to be easy to teach, and some people were going to be difficult, that he was going to go teach anyway. It was really out of compassion. And so he left and he went and started teaching. And then what we are practicing with this month is this path that he taught. It's this eightfold path that he went and shared with his friends. So this is what I want to talk a little bit about. Because what he found, what he went and when he talked to his friends, he was saying that he had found this middle way. When he went to see them, he had to walk a good piece, I think several days to get to them, because I think they were over 100 miles away. So he had to walk a while to get to them. And they saw him coming before he got to them. And they all decided, oh, there's Gotama. He kind of wimped out. We're not going to talk to him because he doesn't know the path. He doesn't have devotion like we do. But as soon as he got there, he began to talk to them. And they didn't really believe, but there's a sutta where he said, I found the path. I found it. I found the path. And they're looking at him, and he does look a little different. And in that looking different, if you've ever been on a retreat, or if you haven't, I've taught so many retreats. We do look different when we are relaxed. There is something profoundly weighty about the way we walk in the world. And when you go on a retreat, even a week long, at the end of that retreat, there's our faces are brighter. We look different. We're not carrying so much weight. And it's not like our lives are different, but something has happened when we go through this path. And retreats are the unfolding of the Eightfold Path. So there's a way that we unfold this Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, really, through the whole retreat. It's the arc of the retreat. And so this path does make us look softer. We look different. We look the same, and yet we look different. And this is what they saw in their friend, and that's why they started listening to him. And then he tells them about this path that he found. So he tells them about the Eightfold Path and the eight factors that we're going to talk about. But to get to that path, he had to understand dukkha. He couldn't just see the path. It's not really like that. He had to spend some time investigating his own dukkha, not theoretically talking about human dukkha and, you know, the dukkha we all live in as human beings. He had to actually spend some time with his own dukkha. And his own dukkha being suffering. So that's the English translation of it. He had to spend some time in his own suffering. So his mom died. Pretty much all his friends left him. He's not really sure this is the right path. He's kind of like winging it. I'm sure he suffered. I'm sure of it. I've sat on too many retreats with my own mind, and I'm sure his mind was like mine, and he had to get through, he had to learn to tame or train this mind that's trapped in habit, and he had the same habit mind that we have. So he had to come face to face and want to investigate that dukkha, that suffering, rather than just ignore it or get past it. He had to want to investigate it, and he had to actually come to understand it. And he told them, his friends, that he realized that the knowing of the presence of dukkha, and that this dukkha, he realized this dukkha should be understood, and that he did understand it. And then he also began to tell them that if he understood this dukkha, he also knew where it came from. And it came from his own clinging to have things other ways. And he began to see all that grasping and clinging he was doing, just like when we see it. And this is what I think I respect so much about this path is, it isn't like somebody is telling you, I'm not telling you, no teacher should be telling you that there's some this and only this way, that the practice itself is to be discovered individually by each one of us, that we have to sit here. And I can say, oh, there's clinging and there's grasping and it's to be abandoned. But that is not the path. That is not the moon. That's like a finger pointing at the moon. But you have to sit there and all of a sudden get a sense, am I holding on to something? Am I, like, where's all this difficulty coming from? And you have to uncover that for yourself. And the same way he uncovered something, we uncovered something, uncover things. That's what this path feels like. It doesn't feel like you learned something from me, but it is a teacher like me can inspire you to try to uncover it and to stay with it until you uncover it. But you really have to uncover the clinging nature of our minds by ourselves. And that's what he said. He had to experience all that clinging, craving. He had to realize that that clinging and craving had to be let go of, and that he realized that he had let go of it. And gradually he had to see what it feels like to have this cessation of dukkha, the cooling. The nibbana is the cooling of the fire of this suffering and dukkha. And he had to have that experience for self. And he had to see this release didn't come from him. That somehow he had to come to an understanding, and everyone in this room and online, we have to come to an understanding that you don't have to fix the difficulty. You don't have to figure out what's the solution to work out my anxiety. What is it that I need to do to make all this start working? And that's our ordinary minds that try to do this. And instead, he realized in this middle way that if he learned to bear the difficulty, let go of the clinging to have it otherwise, that this natural arising phenomena of life passes on its own. Nothing we have to do about it. I don't care how much anxiety I had when I was trying to fix the anxiety. I continue to have anxiety. It's as if my trying to fix it and the mind would be like, oh, let me help Tuari have more anxiety for her to fix, because it just kept producing more anxiety. When I finally stopped fighting that anxiety and learned to hold it, be with it, relax into it, the anxiety began to move and shift on its own, because anxiety is a conditioned phenomena. And if it's conditioned, those conditions are going to change and things are going to change. But the trusting that that is true, that is the nature of the first three truths. The learning that what arises passes comes from beginning to understand dukkha, beginning to see that clinging and craving and letting it go, and feeling the release that comes when you let things be and let things shift and change on their own. So in the course of this moving through the first three truths, I think he came to the path. And I think he came to the path looking back on what he had done and realized that he had actually understood the path, understood suffering, understood his clinging, and he had let it, you know, had the patience for it to release itself. And then he told them that he realized that he understood the path, he saw the path, and he understood that it needed to be developed and that it had been developed. So when he shared this experience, he kept telling all his friends that some vision arose in him and some insight, some discernment, some knowledge, and an illumination arose within him in regards to things he had not seen before. And I think that's such a profound statement, this idea that he would see things that had not been seen before. Because when I, the first time I ever experienced my anxiety releasing itself on its own, I never had seen that. I'd never sort of saw through what I thought anxiety was to this capacity for that anxiety to just shift. I had always saw my anxiety, remembered all these training, skills, relaxation techniques, tools, and I would apply it, and then gradually it would go like, okay, thank you for the tools. And every once in a while, a lot of times, those tools didn't work and the anxiety just stayed there, and I stayed in this aversion with this anxiety, wishing it would go away until I would give up on the sitting or the bell would ring, thankfully, and then I could stop. But when I came to this place where I was not going to fight this anxiety anymore, I was tired of it. I had decided I was just going to be, I know I told you guys, I'm just going to be the queen of anxiety. And, you know, people would come from miles away just to come to me and say, how did you do it? How could you stay with anxiety? And I could tell them how I could stay with anxiety. I thought this anxiety that I had would never go away, never. I did not have a sense that this was a conditioned thing. I thought it was absolute. And I remember being in Sims and I sat down and I felt the flutter of that anxiety and I just sat there with it. And then I just watched it flutter less and less and less. All those years of fighting with this anxiety because I thought I had to fix it, not realizing that I had to allow it to be until the body had figured out how to get rid of all this excess energy I had. And eventually it settled down. So when I saw that, these are profound moments that we see things that we didn't realize, or you always react a certain way, and then you have this profound moment where you don't even know how it is, but you just don't react in your normal way. Something is just different. You don't know how that is, but you see it, and you see that you did not do something to make yourself be otherwise. This kind of understanding, Sharon Salzberg, this is what she uses this towards, you know, loving kindness, because she's like a loving kindness queen. She says, to be truly happy in this world is a revolutionary act. I believe that. It's revolutionary because we live in a world that is bound up, pent up, focused on having you believe that you cannot be truly happy. And this truly happy in this world is a revolutionary act. She said it is a radical change of view that liberates us so that we know who we are most deeply and can acknowledge our enormous ability to love. See, this is what I think happened with me and my anxiety. I think for some reason I fell in love with it rather than was fighting it. Instead of having this resistance and aversion and I don't like it, when I switched and decided I was going to be the anxiety queen of the world, I fell in love with this anxiety. And this anxiety became my gift. something to be understood, something to be known. And in that connection, I think that's what the path is pointing to. It's pointing to having a relationship with something. So it's not a path that we're walking to get somewhere as much as it's a path that cultivates a relationship with something. So there are 8 factors in this path, set up into 3 categories: wisdom, which is right view, right intention. Then there is the middle section, the wisdom section, the first section, which I think is notable, that the first section of the path is actually your view and your intention and not how good a meditator you are. So it's sort of like, how you looking at this? How you framing this? What's your intention here? And that is the first 2 factors to cultivate on the path. And the second set of factors we cultivate is in our ethical conduct. So it's right actions, right speech, right livelihood. Get your conduct there. And then the third aspect is the last, I guess I should say, the last training is then our samadhi, our concentration, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. It comes at the end of the path after we've gotten our view straight. So when I started thinking about this, I like this word right. Some people use wise, but I like the word right because it's pointing to it is the right way to do the first 3 truths. It's the right way to find an understanding of dukkha, to find and notice clinging and abandon it, and to begin to see the cessation of this dukkha or suffering. So the Ajahn Pasano was here. It's kind of weird because he was sitting right here. But he came one time and he compared this right. He said it's the word sama. And sama in Pali, in its common uses, is related to music. So for those of you that know music, it's the harmonious relationship that happens with music. So in a way, what this path is doing is creating a harmonious relationship with difficulty. You're learning to stop fighting our difficulties and come into a harmonious relationship with it so that we can understand it and see. And somehow that harmonious relationship begins to loosen this fight that we have with life. So this being said, I think there are 3 things that I want to leave you with about this path that we're going to start looking at. We're going to look at the path itself, this 4th noble truth, this whole month, and various teachers will come and talk about it in different ways. So I'm not saying the way I'm about to lay this out is the right way. I'm just going to give you something you can consider as part of what you're understanding so you can be in relationship with whatever's happening. And the first thing is to realize that when we start cultivating these 8 factors, we are not cultivating conduct necessarily. We're not trying to make ourselves good beings, right beings. We got to be the perfect kind of being. We're not trying to be the being that is enlightened or awake or, you know, better this, better that, more this, more that. We're not doing that. We are cultivating a possibility, you could think of it, an energetic connection to life that allows for potentiality and possibility. For we're cultivating a way to be with experience that allows that experience to be more than the limited way we may be looking at it right now. That's what the Buddha did. I mean, when he was right before he decided to eat and get his strength and all of that, he was actually ascetic practice. There are Dhamma talks he gave where he talked about how thin his body was and how harsh the life was that they lived, the six of them as ascetic monks. They ate very little. They did not give in to any kind of pain, so they would even go to extremes to bring pain to the body in order to sort of, the idea would be to transcend that pain. We do this, you know. We have some difficulty in a sit and we're going to bear with it until we push through it. We are not going anywhere, or some pain in the body and we are just going to stay with it and not move until it goes away. And so we have the same kind of extreme way of being with difficulty. And the Buddha was realizing that doesn't work. He even tried, you know, blissful states of deep concentration and absorption. It didn't work. So when he had this memory of being a kid, and in that memory realizing that he also was peaceful while there was a whole bunch of stuff going on, when he had that memory, he realized that there must be something else. And that is what I catch myself when I'm struggling in a meditation, we don't know we're struggling. We just start struggling, trying to fix something or make the sit a certain way or make our practice a certain way or make a moment a certain way. We just get caught up in struggling, but we can begin to feel the tension of that. And as we feel the tension of that, instead of double downing, what he did was thought, could there be another way that I could find a different way of relating to this? And this is what I think Sharon was pointing to about it being revolutionary, because you're actually taking the moment and considering the potential, the possibility that there is another way to be with this particular moment, rather than force yourself into winning the argument, force everybody into doing what you want, getting what you think you need. There might be another way than just worrying about some possibility that you don't have any control over. So this leads to the second way that I begin to see this path was less about what was happening externally in the world and more about what's happening internally with me. So even if I'm struggling with some difficulty at work or I was struggling with my family, it didn't matter. I begin to realize it was not about them. It was about me. And not in this, oh, it's all about me. I got to fix myself. There's something wrong. It was in this understanding that what was making this moment difficult was how I was relating to it. So it's an inward journey to understand, how am I relating to this moment in such a way that I could let that struggle go, that I could actually see the realization of the third noble truth. And then lastly, if we could begin to see that this is not about our conduct, that there's something else happening here on this path, there's something that we are beginning to feel into, this something that's has the potential to open in us, and then it's inward. It's the potential comes from inside here, and not, can I be nice enough to make everybody else like me so they'll do what I want and ultimately get what I want? That isn't, it's so limited. You could make that happen. I mean, I took NVC, I took all kinds of things that would help me say it in a nice way, but really, you have to do what I want. That's really all it was about. All that NVC and all of that was really just, if I said it a little differently, maybe then, you know, you would, you know, agree with me. But what I think this path is ultimately teaching us, it's getting us sensitive to understanding love and harm. And we're beginning to see it from the inside out. And in it, whatever it is that we need to see, it's not something we already know. It's not something you learned when you were in, you know, kindergarten. It's not something we've learned through all our years of schooling. It's not something we learned from our parents. It's not something we learned from any book or any kind of, you know, academic study. It's not any of that. It's in a moment in time when you're having a difficulty and you soften into it to consider that there might be another way to relate to it. It's in that. In that moment, you can begin to see something different. And in that seeing something different, that's where we have a sense of freedom. So part of what I wanted to talk about in a way, This is the last piece I wanted to share on this, because it's there's all kinds of ways for us to see things differently, all kinds of ways. I am nothing like I used to be, and I am exactly like I have always been. So there is a strangeness about me, and I know my family. I just spent a long night with them last night. They are just so, they just don't know what to do with me, because I'm so exactly like I used to be, and I'm so different. And one of the ways that I am different, I just want to bring this in a little bit, because we're coming into the month for climate and understanding the our natural world that we live in. I never cared about the natural world. Never. I mean, I would go outside and do things like play baseball or whatever, but I would not say I was the camping type, or I always wanted to go camping, but my family didn't do it, and I was not going to go by myself. So I never really had a relationship with nature that I would say. I just kind of mostly was a inner city cement person. The more cement there was, the better I felt. So When I started practicing, I had a moment. We used to do non-residentials. I mean, we did beginning classes, and then we would have these day-longs at this church in Mercer Island. And one day, and this church was beautiful. It was all out in these woods, and it was just, I mean, it was right in the middle of the city area, like suburbs, but it was somehow tucked in around these trees and woods. And one time I was doing my walking meditation, and I was walking towards one tree, turn around, walk towards the other tree. And I was just walking, thinking. I didn't really even like walking meditation back then, but you know, you got to do it. It's not like Rodney wasn't looking around, so you sort of got to do it. So I'm doing my walking meditation back and forth, and I'm looking at this tree, and I begin to see ants on the tree. And as I saw these ants on the tree, I saw these like spider webs, and all of a sudden the intricacy of this tree became more and more and more alive to me. And I turned around at the end of that one, and I walked to the other tree, and I could see the tree, how big it was, the space it was taking up. And in this walking back and forth, I had this profound experience with nature. It was so profound. And I realized by the end of that sort of walking that we don't actually practice without nature. We don't actually do this practice by ourselves. It's why I realized the Buddha got so interconnected with the tree, is because it's not just this building, but the building is actually on the land. But it's also the whole weekend. Just think about those of you that was here over the weekend, the practicing outside, the practicing in the hall, the whole practice, part and parcel of it is being with land. We cannot do this practice without having a relationship with the land we're practicing on. And so there's a way in which this path is not just leading us to cultivate our own liberation. It is true, but I know this may sound a little woo-woo, but it's like, the more liberated I get, the more liberated I know everybody in this room is going to get. The more liberated everybody on this call is going to get. The more liberated everything around me becomes. Everything that I experience and everything that I can't even go places without naming trees and calling them people. And I've even had trees kind of give me the stank eye because that may not be their name, but I name them that anyway because they don't talk to me, so they don't say nothing. But it's just a little bit of this whole path has awakened me to way more than just do I like what's happening in my life. It's about way more than that. It is about our relationship with this natural world that we live in. And so I just want us to, you know, to just think about your relationship you have with life itself, with, you know, the world around you, your relationship you have with work, at home, with the neighborhood you live in. This path is really about this potentiality that you have to be in relationship with everything. Everything. It's sort of a, what's his name? Mingyur Rinpoche's book, In Love with the World. That's sort of what I have become, which is kind of strange because I was at my family's house, a lot of drinking, crazy. I had a great time. And I think that's what was, they were probably used to me snapping at them, yelling at them. And I didn't yell at anybody. I was okay. And that is because I am in relationship with them, not judging what they're doing. They do what they want to do, but I'm in relationship with them nonetheless. That's what I think this path is cultivating in us. So let's just take a moment and we'll sit quietly here and then I'll see if you have any comments or questions. Thank you so much for your kind attention, your practice, your sincerity. I will say this. If you have not read the book, actually, it's not reading Braiding Sweetgrass. I think you should listen to Braiding Sweetgrass. I think it's a bit much to try to read it because she's a storyteller. But if you ever get an audio recording of Braiding Sweetgrass, your relationship with the natural world will change dramatically. She really knows. It's a native woman who's a biologist, and she knows how to talk about what in the Western mind we lose because of our objective way of dealing with the world. And yet, in this more indigenous way of being with the world, you actually do learn how to be in relationship. And she happens to use it with the native, the natural world. But I think if you want to learn how to be in relationship with life or with people or with work or whatever you want to be in relationship with, even your anxiety, that book is a great book on teaching you how to be in relationship. And that is what I think the path is pointing to. So let's see if there's anybody that has anything they'd like to share.
All right. I'm trying to think about how to be concise. I think the last few weeks I've been thinking about how does Buddhism relate to kind of the issues, our political issues, and I understand suffering and clinging. I mean, I understand it, and sometimes I experience it. And
maybe once or twice.
Yeah. And like on the one hand, I hear a lot about accepting as like the way to let things, accepting as the way, like not clinging, right, is the end of suffering. And on the other hand, I feel like there is just, like you just don't want to stand by while evil happens.
Oh, yeah.
So, and it's, yeah. So,
I think that's a misunderstanding of what you're accepting.
Okay, good.
So
tell me.
You're not accepting does not mean condoning. Accepting means a lot of times when we don't like something, we kind of don't look at it. We kind of look away. So it's more of we hide and we spin in our anger, but we don't actually do anything about it. So accepting is more of
acknowledging the truth that this is happening. This is not just made up stuff. This is actually happening. If you learn to accept that something is actually happening, then you can actually move from compassion to do something with it. You have to actually feel suffering in order to do something about it. And the thing that Buddhism is doing, Buddhism is not actually, this might seem harsh, but Buddhism does not care about the American political system. It does not care. It is not about how do I use this practice to fix the American system. It's not. Mainly because whatever political system we live in is made up of millions of people doing something, and that is the system we then have to live with. What Buddhism is about is helping you get right with who you are, be grounded in who you are, so you can move through the world in the way that you want or feel is the inherent within your values. And even if it means you run face to face with difficulty, you will do it anyway. That there is a difference between wanting out there to be fixed so I don't have to do anything that is challenging. And there is being willing to stand up for what you know is right in the face of whatever fear might come that way. And that Buddhism is about working on your capacity to live out of your values no matter what is going on. No matter what's happening outside. And that doesn't mean sitting there and meditating. You're sitting and meditating so you can build up the courage to stand up for your values and to stand up against tyranny, hatred, harm, all of it. But if we don't cultivate an inner core or a sense of sangha, then we will not do anything. We will hate it, but we will not actually do anything against it. And that's the difficulty that we face. So what the practice is designed to do is to build courage within you, build a sense of stability, resilience, a sense of faith in your own values, so that that is what guides you and not fear and trepidation. That fear and trepidation, I think that's why Germany just stayed the way it was. Everybody was scared. Everybody was scared, not just the Jewish people. Everybody was scared. And the more scared you get, the less you will do because you're too afraid. And so you need a practice that's going to build an inner core that you will not be afraid to stand up for what you know is right. Do you see? And you can't build that without being in a room like this, on a screen like this, with a whole bunch of people, feels like you, and we're all got some courage now. We can do it. But if you were like by yourself, you could be like, get some courage. Even when I had anxiety, I would have to imagine monks would come in and sit next to me so that I would not be afraid and want to get up. If I didn't have people sitting there with me, I would just get up and not do it. And so you have to sort of come up with a way to cultivate sangha to allow you to keep building that inner courage.
I have to go to a lot of physical therapy, or have historically just been going because I've got like this side of me just doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's wound up, it's tight. I feel like I don't even breathe out of this side of my chest, and I kind of don't. I was coming here tonight, and, as I was leaving the house, my kids started screaming. They told me not to go, and they just were screaming and screaming and screaming. And I didn't come last week because I knew that was going to happen. And it happens when I leave the house a lot. And just at the top of their lungs screaming. And I was so angry, I threw an orange piece at the cupboard. And I had to leave the house. And I was going to go to a bar, actually. I was so, like, distraught at that point. I'm like, I'm going to go to a bar instead of coming here. And I just drove slowly, and I made it all the way here, and I decided to stay in. And when you describe being the queen of anxiety, I just sat there, and I'm like, I'm really angry. Like, I'm actually angry. And all of a sudden, for the first time, this side of me loosened up, and I could breathe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. It makes a lot of sense, because we hold a lot, and our bodies are carrying an ungodly amount of weight. Not weight like physical mass, but weight energetically. And it is trying and trying and trying to get rid of it. But we just live in minds that are very limited in its understanding. So the fact, first of all, I just want you to thank yourself all the way home about coming here and bringing all that anger with you, bringing all that energy here, settling down, and actually giving the body the capacity to loosen some of this up. And it doesn't loosen up. It's like I said, sometimes the anxiety tools worked and sometimes they didn't. But you are building a relationship with a body that has the potential to loosen all that up. And it's not being afraid. And not, sometimes you'll feel like, I got it. And sometimes you feel like, I had it. And then, I got it. I had it. And it just keeps going like that. But this is what I think Buddha had to come to understand. He probably went through the same thing we do, up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. But his persistence and his sincerity of staying with it is what leads us to something different. So you don't know how long it'll take for that anger to loosen up in you. And you don't know how long it's going to take for the body to release all the excess tension that's built up. But I do know that your chances of it loosening and releasing is a lot surer, is not a lot, is surer in practice than it is just going to a bar. You might get it loosened a little, but it just comes right back. It just numbs it a little and it stays right there. So the truth that it will release however long it takes, that's what you want to bank on in the practice.
I just wanted to say that pain is inevitable and suffering is optional.
Yeah. It is the nature of our human existence for us to experience pain. I mean, we have wimpy bodies, a virus that we can't even see. It's not even a living being, and he can take us down. But the suffering, the mental torment because of it is what's killing us. Yes, Suze?
Big thank you for your talk tonight. And thinking about the beliefs and the views that get so reified in us, that there's something about it, the loosening of the grip around those beliefs of how things are, how I am, how you are, what the world is, yada, yada. Can you talk more about the relationship with those views. I mean, I'm grateful what the practice has given me. One of the things is I ask myself a lot, is this true?
Yes.
Is this true? You know, yeah, you thought it for a gazillion years, but thank you.
You're spot on, Suze, that I, for me, it was this idea that if I am having any kind of difficulty, it is, I am holding something in a distortion, just flat out. If I have difficulty, there's a distortion here. I don't know what it is, and I'm not always sure if I'm even willing to accept that it's a distortion, but there's a knowing that almost what you're saying, it is the pain, the difficulty is part of life. But if I'm having some mental torment, some stress about it, there's a distortion. And the reason why I think personally that the Buddha put view and intention as the beginning trainings, as opposed to meditation the way we do it. Everybody wants to learn how to meditate and concentrate, but really he wanted us to check our view and our intention, is because the intention you set, the body will move towards it. So if you set an intention to be kind, you will begin to move towards kindness. If you begin to set an intention that says, you know, that this is not me. It's not, these things are not, the world is not based out of this identity that I think I have. That it changes all the time, and that the whole world is based on the conditions coming together in a moment in time. And it could come together completely different tomorrow. It could come together, you of everybody knows, like me, that things can just shift on a dime without us even recognizing that. We walk around as if we know what's going to happen tomorrow. But it can shift on a dime and your whole world is different. And that recognition, I think the Buddha wanted us to cultivate that as an intentional thing, starting day one, so that our behavior will follow right along with that understanding. And the more our behavior follows, the more we will gradually settle down and want to get quiet and still. That just begins to come with it. So that's why I think the watching our view, watching our intentions first and foremost. If you're struggling, probably something wrong with that view. Probably something wrong with that. It's not so much your intention, but you can check to see if that intention is operating out of some kind of greed or resistance, aversion, or is it actually operating out of kindness? And I've never had an intention that's operating out of kindness, non-harm, ever have any tension to it. Ever. I've never had it. But I had plenty of tension with aversion and greed. All right. Well, let's send the merit of our practice off into the world. You know, if you just take a moment to just feel back here where you were when you first came in the hall. Feel the body sitting. Chairs may be a little harder. That's good. So you can really feel it. Yeah, and the floor. You can feel the hardness of the floor. The temperature in the room, wherever you're at, that temperature. Just take a moment and listen to the sounds that are arising. This present moment. There's something actually spectacular about coming together and practicing. I believe wholeheartedly that a lot of the
dysfunctionality in the world is because of this increase in meditation. I just believe that getting quiet and getting still is scary to a lot of people. And there's a lot of quiet stillness in the world. And I don't believe that this meditation isn't having an impact on the world. I believe it is. And I believe it gets scary and people get nervous and not sure what to do and they get reactive. But we just stay steady and continue to cultivate this loving stillness. Cultivate the courage that comes with it, the resilience that comes with it, the groundedness that comes with it, and then whatever else that's beneficial that comes with our being together and practicing, we want to send it out in the world. It becomes light and darkness, that it becomes, you know, nurturing sustenance in places where people have nothing. And then it becomes a kindness for places where kindness seems like it's non-existent. And may our practice support all beings, whether they are trees or bushes or grasses, flowers, whether they're the insects, the fish, the birds, or beings that walk on the land, human beings and non-human beings, all beings. May our practice support them in understanding suffering and the freedom that comes with the path leading to the end of suffering. Thank you so much. I love it, love it, love it. It's been so long since I've been here, but I'll be gone for a few months and then I'll be back again in the summer. So thank you for being here. Thank you for your practice. And I'm looking forward to when we see each other again.